Hi again, everybody. John Porteous of the Lovells Township Historical Society here, and you're listening to the Backcast Podcast. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Fun show for you today. We've got, I think as you guys may know, we've got Grey Rock coming up here pretty soon, which is a rod makers conclave that's held in the Grayling area. It'll be in Lovells again this year. And to have some fun with it, Richard and I sit down with a rod maker of distinction. His name's Jeff Wagner. Aside from teaching Richard how to make rods, this gentleman just produces pieces of work, of art. They're just gorgeous. So by all means, check out his website. That's in the show notes. And let's just get to it and have some fun. So here we go.
Jeff is a celebrated rod maker hailing from Ohio. And Jeff, welcome. How are you, sir?
I'm well. Celebrated? Who's celebrating me?
We are.
Well, thank you.
You were silly enough to say yes to our podcast invitation.
So. I know how you don't like to be considered a poobah, but whatever's close to a poobah, you've made it, man. You know?
Well, thanks. Yeah, listen to some of the other podcasts. They're very good. So that was the reason why I decided to join you. So thank you for the invitation.
Well, thank you, Jeff. And, we're not going to blow smoke or stroke you or anything. But, folks, if you're not familiar with Jeff's work, it's really worth a quick trip to the Internet to see what this gentleman has produced. It's just incredible. So with that in mind...
Well, this isn't your only exposure. You've been, you had a segment on public TV once too, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, was it the American Masters or something like that?
It was called Craftsman's Legacy. It was a TV show. It may still even be running, but if people are interested, they should be able to find the episode on YouTube, I believe.
Yeah, you are. I hesitate to use the word celebrated, but I don't know what another one that fits so well.
Well, aside from all the accolades, the meat and potatoes part of it is, this is something you do and not just as a hobby. This is what you do. Am I correct?
Yeah, it's a job.
Well, hopefully a labor of love, but and something that's not exactly a new deal. You've been got 2 or 3 decades in this, don't you?
Yeah, I think this is our 28th year doing it on a full-time basis. Our little company consists of myself and my partner, Kazmyra Orlowski, and she recently sort of semi-retired from the business, but, you know, we were building rods side by side, you know, for all this time.
That's awesome. I'll follow up on that in a moment because I do have a question about how that works.
That's noteworthy because, but according to the people who say they ought to know, there's about 100 or 1,000, rather, rod makers active in the country. And there's probably a dozen that are actually able to do it and make enough money to live on it.
Yeah.
Does that sound about right to you?
Yeah, that sounds about right. I mean, you kind of have to sort of take the vow of poverty, you know, if you want to do it as a full-time job. It's, you know, when you look at the price of a rod, you might think, oh, you know, there's a lot of money to be made in this. But basically, you're just kind of going along from month to month. You don't see many people doing it, and especially with families and stuff like that, it's just an impossible way to go.
Yeah, it's like being a fly fishing guy. You need a wife who's a lawyer or a dentist. You know?
Tank full of
there
fish.
You go. Or a trust fund. That would be real nice.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. Kind of like the old racing thing, you know, how to make $1 million in racing is to start with $10 million.
There you go. Yep.
Yeah. But regardless, you've been able to make it work. What's... is there a secret? Is persistence? Just perseverance?
Just like a ton of hard work. I know how that can sound to some people. You know, everybody works hard, but it's something that I never felt like, you know, heading out into the shop. I was actually going to work. You know, I loved it, so I didn't mind working 7 days a week and long hours and everything like that. So, you know, yeah, I think, you know, there's a certain amount of persistence involved with it and a love for it and a desire to do it. And, you know, the years pass and here we are.
Well, was this something, I mean, was this 12-year-old you going, this is going to be 50-year-old me?
Kind of, sort of, in a way. When I was young, I liked to make things. Back in junior high, at that time, when I was in junior high, all students, girls and boys, were required to take two classes. You had to take home economics, and they would teach you sort of like how to take care of yourself if your mother was at work. And you also had to take metal shop. And, you know, around here, all the manufacturers that were here for the auto industry, et cetera, they were trying to get people trained for vocations, basically. And I took metal shop, and I absolutely loved it. And my father was a machinist, so I remember sitting around one dinner time, and I asked him if I could come in to work with him for a day. And my dad said, well, what do you want to do that for? And I said, well, I think I'd like to be a machinist. And my parents were, like, horrified. They're like, you're going to college, you know? And so I ended up going to college, but, you know, I think I just enjoy making things.
I think there's a lot to be said for that, and it's kind of rare air when you're allowed to pursue something for your livelihood that you really do enjoy and you have a passion for, and it's not work. And it's, while work is certainly a key element of success, it's not you know, it's like, ugh, gotta do this. It's you've got pretty decent working conditions, I'm guessing.
Yeah. My boss was kind of a jerk, you know, but other than that, being self-employed has some good things to it, too.
Nice. Well, so you come from the background you just detailed. What are you a fly angler as a kid, or are you a bait angler, or?
Well, yeah, I started out fishing bait, you know, around here in northern Ohio. We had a number of ponds that were close by, you know, fish for bass and catfish and bluegills and stuff like that. But I really got into it because of my maternal grandfather. He was a coal miner from central Pennsylvania. He developed black lung in the 50s. Then he moved his family here to Cleveland to be a mechanic. And he missed the hunting and fishing and stuff that he had in central Pennsylvania, so he purchased a cabin in the Allegheny National Forest. And as kids, he would take us up there, and he would take us out fishing, and you know, he taught me how to catch a brook trout and how to catch trout and smallmouth bass in streams and stuff like that, and I just sort of took to it. And in my early teens, I developed an interest in learning how to fly fish. And my grandfather and his brother, you know, were both really avid outdoorsmen, but they didn't know how to fly fish. So I just got a fly rod and started kind of flailing away. And I flailed around for a real long time until, you know, finally something in it sort of clicked, and I could catch a fish every now and then.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And that's, you know, the story that we hear all so often. It's just, you know, the evolution and such. And so now you're finding fish on the end of a fly rod. When did kind of the focus turn into what you were holding in your hand and how that was crafted?
Well, I pretty much fish came from the get-go. My father and mother, they loved going to, like, garage sales and flea markets and stuff like that. And my first cane rod was this Montague combination fly rod spinning rod that my father picked up at a garage sale or a flea market. And I just started using it. And cane is just something that I've always been like drawn to, you know. It's like a magnet. I don't know how to explain it in any other way. It just has its own unique feel and look, and I kind of just was drawn to it. And whereas, you know, like at the time, at that time, this would be like in the mid 70s, the main type of rod that people used and purchased was fiberglass. But you know, there were cane rods out there, and so I'm fishing this real cheap one. And I always had a dream of like getting a good one. It was like a dream object. And so I think it was in 1979 or 78, I purchased like what I consider my first real bamboo fly rod. It was a Constable rod that I purchased from a fly shop here in Cleveland. And that kind of started the whole thing.
It's a little different for each person, but I mean, at that point, is it like, okay, I like this one, but what if it did this, or what if it did that, or why do these go here, or who makes this rod, or things like that? Is that kind of how those questions start percolating?
A little bit. I mean, the thing was for me was that now I remember I was really fortunate because, you know, you don't think of Cleveland as being like this hotbed for fly fishing. But around that time, a little mail order fly fishing store opened up. It was called Angler's Mail, and it was just a few miles from my house. So I'd ride my little bicycle over there and take my paper route money and go in and buy little fly boxes and flies and stuff like that. And like I said, most of the rods at that time, you know, were fiberglass, and they were no exception. They had a lot of fiberglass, but they also always had, like, a few cane rods. And if you were really lucky, you could get to cast one and everything. But, you know, it was like a dream object, you know. And so I always wanted one, and, you know, so I was finally able to acquire a decent one.
What are those... high on the wall, behind the glass type of things. Yeah,
or in the showcase, you know, and you know, where people can't touch it or something like that.
Exactly,
you know?
With magic little light twinkling off the end of it. Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
It was like the most expensive thing in the store, you know, so naturally you wanted it, you know.
Sure, absolutely. Oh, that's funny.
Well, you taught me and pass a bunch of other guys how to make rods, but you know, all of the years since 2004 when I took the class, I've never really known. How did you learn to make rods?
Well, it kind of started out, I was actually making other things from wood. I was making wooden rod tubes and fly boxes and nets and stuff like that, and I sold them at some of the area stores here, you know, around Cleveland. And I was delivering a bunch of this stuff one day to a fly shop in Chagrin Falls, and I saw Wayne Catinaw's book had just come out on the shelf, Handcrafting Bamboo Fly Rods. So I got the book, and I was, like, so excited, you know, you know, you could actually do this, you know, and I'm reading it on my steering wheel on the way home. So that's kind of what... What induced me to, you know, to give it a try.
So you self-taught yourself out of Wayne's book?
Yep.
Nice job.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I mean, that was a major... I'm sorry, go ahead, Rick.
I thought that was probably the best result that ever came out of that book.
Well, I give it a lot of credit, you know, because I had students over the years that purchased the Garrison book when it came out, and were so intimidated that they never even attempted it, you know, because he approached the craft in a very different way than Wayne. And I think what Wayne's book did was it sort of stripped it down to its bare essence and eliminated a lot of the pseudoscientific mumbo jumbo and made it an approachable thing, you know, that hey, you know, you can do this. You don't need to be an engineer or a rocket scientist or whatever, you know. if you just follow these series of steps, you know, you're going to get in the end, you're going to be holding a rod in your hand. So I give him a lot of credit for that.
Wayne did do a hell of a lot to make rod making accessible to regular folks.
Yep.
You know, without engineering degrees.
Yeah, yep. I could readily see and identify with what you're saying. The Garrison book is completely intimidating. It just,
yep.
Yeah.
Anyways, you do a lot of, you sell a lot of tools, and you got a thing going with reels, and you used to do a lot of vintage stuff. Do you still do that?
Oh, yeah. You know, when you were talking about, you know, so few people doing this, you know, as a full-time thing, when Casmira came on board and started working together, you know, it became obvious really quick that, like, rods couldn't be the only thing we did. So we started to expand a little bit, and we provide rod building tools. You know, for 23 years or so, we did rod building classes. We still do quite a bit of vintage tackle sales. That's getting to be a bigger part of our business. So it had to be diversified out, you know, and so that's kind of what has allowed us to survive in the field.
Well, I'm looking around the shop here, and you know, I can see several items that I got from you several
did
times.
Did you read the instructions, though? That's the question.
Yeah, well, I have them all here. And occasionally when I get something out, I have to get the book out from the class from 2004 and read it. The one thing I can never remember is where they put the enamel on the roughing forms. I almost always have to get the book out and look at that. It could be. That's probably a defect in my learning ability or something.
It's a pretty cool coaching tree. Is year before last, I made a rod under Richard's guidance.
That's fantastic, man.
Yeah, good fun. So, well, okay. So you're making rods. You've got the book. How did you determine? Was there a taper you wanted to emulate? Was there something that, hey, I bet I could make this and have more fun doing it than paying a lot of money for this brand X rod?
No, not really. I mean, you know, I just kind of like jumped in, you know, and so, you know, I made a few rods and I found out that people wanted to buy them. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll make rods here for people to buy. So that's kind of how it all started.
Gotcha. Well, that's about as good an outcome as you could ask for, I believe. works through the haze pretty easily that way. The well, so today, do you teach students now? Or
No, I retired from that. Last year was the first year in like 23 years, I think, that I retired and no longer do the classes.
Good on you.
Wow.
Good on
yeah.
you. So, well, I'm guessing maybe allows for an extra day or two on the water sometimes?
Yep. Yeah, that's part of it. I kind of missed the classes a little bit, but it was, you know, it was a huge, huge time investment to do them. And I certainly don't miss things like moving our shop out to Sunnybrook Trout Club where we used to hold them and, you know, moving the whole shop there, moving it back, all the prep work, all that sort of stuff. So that's
sure.
stuff I don't miss.
Oh, totally understand that. The and again, we touched on it briefly at the beginning, but your rods are aesthetically beautiful. They're just incredible. What is that the artisan background that you grew up with, getting to flourish? What are the influences there?
Maybe a little bit. I think, like, the major influence as it relates to fly rods is just, you know, looking at other people's work and, you know, having the admiration for, you know, people that make really, really beautiful rods, you know, and there's any number of those. And then, you know, trying your best to, you know, emulate that standard, you know, to keep a high standard going.
Sure. There's one that I'm just, and this is my own lack of, you know, worldly knowledge, but the swelled butt on several of those rods that you've crafted is just, wow. I'm not even sure how one would think of that, let alone craft it.
Are you talking about the rods that have like the splice butt with wood inserts and stuff like that?
Yeah, it seems to flare as it approaches the top of the grip.
Right. Yeah, those are referred to as like mortised rods, or commonly called, or 12-strip rods. It's actually a very, very old idea. I picked up an old tackle catalog, and I don't know if I have it behind me here on the shelf. It's probably here somewhere. But they were made in the early portion of rod building, you know, like around 1910 up to about 1920. And you could actually purchase one that had that feature very cheap. And so what that kind of tells you is that, well, if you can manufacture that item fairly cheap, it can't be that difficult. And so in order to figure out how to make it, I purchased one of these old rods and then delaminated it and saw how it was constructed. And that, you know, gave me the insight into how they were built, you know. So I started building, you know, some of those.
Well, again, confessing to my simplicity, it looks pretty cool to me. And I would definitely encourage the listeners to do a little bit of internet searching, because it's pretty impressive. Do you, and to that end, you're doing a lot of your own metal work now, for the reel seats and butt caps and such?
Yep. Yeah, that kind of all started, you know, something that I wanted to do for a long time, but never found the time. You know, I was just too busy making rods to sort of divert into something that wasn't going to pay off right away. And back when the housing crisis hit, business slowed down really substantially, and I had more time. And so I purchased an old tool room lathe to learn metalworking, and started making the parts for what we call our classic series rods, with all of the metalwork, the ferrules and the reel seats, made in-house. And I found that the metalworking, I just loved it, you know. I'd be, you know, standing at the bench planing a rod, and I kept, like, turning my head, like, staring at the lathe, you know. It was like I was over here, but I wanted to be over there. And so I started thinking, well, you know, I've got this beautiful lathe, and what else can I do with it? And so I thought, well, you know, maybe I can make a reel, you know. So that's how I got started into making the reels.
Well, and I think that's something that we definitely want to touch on, more than just say you're started to make reels. You've got, like most of your other stuff, it's kind of, you know, artwork. In addition to being just brilliantly crafted, what tell the listeners about the reels, kind of background, context, that sort of thing.
Okay. Well, it's really a sort of similar story to the rods. You know, I had a real attraction to the rods, or the reels made by a gentleman by the name of Edward von Hoff. And he made really, really spectacular reels. And, you know, like I was saying, that, you know, the most expensive thing always attracted me, you know, whether it was a cane fly rod. Well, it was the same way with von Hoff reels. You know, they were sort of considered to be the epitome of a reel maker's art. And so when I got an interest in making reels, that's where I gravitated towards, was using that as my sort of benchmark, you know, for making a fine reel, were the Edward von Hoff perfection reels. And so that's what I set out to learn how to make.
Just they're gorgeous. As you're crafting these, are you employing traditional techniques or using some modern leverage with CNC or anything like that?
No, it's all handwork on manual machines. I've got, like I said, that tool room lathe. I've got a very ancient hard-inch mill, horizontal mill, with a really ancient Bridgeport head. And I've got a pantograph, and our parts are made by hand, you know, manually on those machines.
So, go ahead.
Well, you seem to, you came in at the top of the market there. I mean, there wasn't any of this horsing around with the everyday click ball reel, you know, pedestrian type thing. And I've seen the reels, and they are really, really nice. I got to sell my truck or something to get by one.
Well, thanks, man. Yeah, it's kind of like, I mean, that was just like what I wanted to do, and I couldn't see much sense in trying to, you know, make a hearty lightweight or something like that. I mean, you know, not that that's not a great reel. I own them, and I fish with them and everything like that. But, you know, that the Vom Hof Perfection reels were the ones that really just, you know, turned me on, and that's what I wanted to work in.
Again, it actually makes a lot of sense. I mean, you just go for the best. You know?
Absolutely. For those that are listening and maybe not readily in front of a picture, can you describe kind of maybe some of the mechanics and features that did make this a little more than, if you will, the pedestrian reel?
Yeah, the Vom Hof reels were made, you know, back at the time. I think they were introduced around 1890. And it was a real sort of cutting-edge reel. The side plates were made out of this new material called ebonite, which is hard rubber. And all the other components were nickel silver, just very beautifully crafted. Not only, you know, from, you know, a craftsmanship viewpoint, but from an artistic point of eye. Like, you can take one of these reels that was made in 1900 and put it in an art museum, you know? I mean, that's how beautiful they are. You could put it on a modern graphite rod, and it'll look fantastic on a graphite rod. You can put it on a cane rod. So that's what kind of, you know, drew me to these things, because it's sort of a timeless design. And Edward Vom Hof, you know, he concentrated on making, you know, the very best article that he could make. You know, he wasn't interested in make mass producing reels, you know, and making something that was kind of, you know, mundane or just functional. It was trying to make like the best of the best, and I think, you know, he really accomplished that.
It's cool to hear that. I grew up with a dad that was a watch and a clockmaker, and there were occasions where he'd call you in and he'd go, okay, now here's why this is a really big deal, and here's why this one isn't. And you could quickly see and gain an appreciation for just the extra time, the craftsmanship, the attention to the detail, and just the extra intangibles that go into everything.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the word gets overused a lot, you know, but I really believe the guy was a genius. You know, the drag system inside of him is extremely ingenious. And like I said, I mean, you could take a reel out, you know, that was made in 1900, and you can go fish with it. You know, they're really remarkable pieces of craftsmanship.
That's awesome. So what's on your summer calendar? Have you got any destination fishing planned? Or
well, I spend about 6 weeks of the year in the spring over in central Pennsylvania, so I've got that to look forward to. Later in the year, we'll just see what happens. I've been wanting to get down to fish in some other places, and so we'll see how the year shapes up.
When you're in central Pennsylvania, you're targeting spring hatches there, or specific bugs, or just
I'm a dry fly nut. You know, that's all I do. Not into doing the nymph thing or anything like that. So, yeah, I'm trying to hit all the major hatches and fish it until those kind of peter out in like mid to late June, and then I'm back in the shop. And you know, in the past years, I would come back and start gearing up for classes and stuff like that, but. And you know, my time was invested there, but now since I'm retired from that, maybe I'll have more time to fish. So we'll see.
Got any overseas plans? You going to go back down and see Nick again, or well, you went over to that Italian rod makers thing a few years, didn't you?
Yeah, we've been fortunate enough to be invited to speak at the at what's called IBRA, the Italian Bamboo Rod Makers Association. They hold their gatherings in Tuscany. And like I said, super fortunate to be able to go to that twice. It's an incredible, incredible event. Got to go to Tasmania a few years back at the invitation of the rod builders in Australia. I don't have any immediate plans to return, but it's always out there, so we'll see.
When you're visiting with the Italian rod makers, what is that experience like? Is there a lot of common ground? Are there differing philosophies?
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of common ground. There's a ton of common ground, and when I got to go over to Europe, Kazmir and I were invited twice there. We did invited to speak at a gathering of rod builders in Bavaria on one occasion. And it's really cool. I mean, you've got this kinship of people that, are building rods, like, all over the world. And the thing I found really interesting about the Europeans is that I think they were a little bit more innovative and kind of open-minded about cane rods. Like, here, it's almost reached, like, this dogma state of, okay, this is how you build a rod, this is what it should look like, et cetera, et cetera. And them being there, they're not necessarily, bound by that and will do some pretty wild stuff, So it was a real eye-opener to get to go there. And the Italians especially, I mean, they really know how to put on a gathering. I mean, you're not sitting around in the evening with a pizza and a beer, around a campfire. You're having a six-course meal and champagne and everything else. I mean, it's remarkable.
Very nice.
Sounds like something you could tolerate for a while.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But not impossible duty. That's pretty cool.
Have you heard from Nick lately?
I go back and forth with him several times a week, yep.
Good. He's a good guy.
Yeah, he's now, they moved, him and his wife moved to New Zealand about a year or so ago, so now he's in New Zealand, and he's not suffering, so.
Wow.
Is he still commercial rod maker? We're talking about Nick Taransky, by the way.
Yep, he's still making beautiful rods, just now he's doing it in New Zealand.
All right, cool.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that doesn't suck. I mean, you should see the pictures I get.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I should, actually.
But I have this better student teaching down there. It's still on the list, yeah. Wow. So we've got some free time for fishing, things going on. Maybe, if we lobby hard enough and keep sending you postcards, you'll make a trip north and we'll get a chance to shake your hand in person.
Well, I think I was last up there was with Nick, I think about 2 or 3 years ago, and it's always a great time. I have such fond memories of all the times I've been able to make it up to the gathering in Grayling. One of the first ones I ever did, God, way, way back, was back when they had it at the Fly Factory, in the very early years.
Sure.
And, the area around Levels and that whole area up there has got such a cool unique vibe, which is I think one of the great things about fly fishing is that you can travel around to these different places and they're all sort of unique. They've got their own traditions and the water is a little different and all of that, and you know, I just love being up there, and it's such a wonderful place.
Well, thank you. We'll look forward to your next visit. And Jeff, thanks again, man. We really appreciate you taking time out of the day to talk to us and our listeners, and look forward to further conversations.
I appreciate you asking. Thanks so much.
We'll give you a link, so if you want to pass it around to your pals who...
yeah, absolutely. We can feel free to socialize in your newsletter.
I'll pop it into the newsletter. Thank you.
Right on. Thank you, Jeff. Be well, sir.
Happy rock building, guys.
Okay, take it easy.
Right on.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, aside from the goodbye that would never end, fun conversation with Jeff, and again, just his rods are incredible, and they cast nicely too. So not only beautiful to look at, but beautiful to cast. So hope you guys enjoyed it. We enjoyed bringing it to you. The museum is open again this weekend. We're in our normal summer hours, Saturday from 11 to 3, and if you're in the area and can't make it during that time, by all means, drop us an email, and we'll make arrangements, and you can bring yourself or your group over, and we'll bring you through the museum. So there you have it. Until next time, mind your back, cast.